Scrotus Founds London, taken from Prehistoric London by E. O. Gordon. In the Chronicles, it is stated that Brutus, minded to build himself a chief city, went round the whole circuit of the land in search of a fitting site. When he came to the River Thames, he found the very spot best suited to the purpose. He therefore founded his city there, and called it New Troy, and by this name it was known for many ages thereafter, until at last, by corruption of the word, it came to be called Trinovantium. A glance at the index of an atlas shows that London was not the only city in Europe to have been called after the historic Troy. There are two towns of that name in Italy and one in France. In the ancient Troy on the Tagus, although practically destroyed by the earthquake, many remains of so-called Phoenician masonry may still be seen. In our own case, we have to account for the loss of the name of Troy before the Roman invasion in 52 BC. The solution of the difficulty may be that the older prehistoric name of the Llandin triumphed over the alien appellation of Car Troia. Brutus's knowledge of the different seaports of the Mediterranean would have led him at once to appreciate the exceptional capabilities of the site of the Cymric Car, perched on a hillock on the narrowest reach of a tidal river, with two natural ports, the Walbrook and the Fleet, and practically impregnable by land, girt in as it was by primeval forest on the north, and by fen and moor on the east and west, and unapproachable from the south, the shore from Battersea and Greenwich being one unbroken expanse of mud, some 8 miles long, varying from 2 to 2.5 in width, twice in every 24 hours submerged by the tide. The numerous prehistoric remains unearthed in the city and figured in the catalogue of the Guildhall Museum afford positive proof of a Neolithic occupation succeeded by that of the Bronze Age. The evidence of these material remains point to the probability that the original settlers were no other than the first wave of emigrant under Hugh Godan, the mounds and circle builders of Britain. Seeing that the great waterway of the Severn had its Glastonbury and its Caerleon, and the south coast its Totnes and its Winton, it is most unlikely that the site of London would have been neglected from the coming of Hugh Godan in the time of Abraham, to the arrival of Brutus and his Trojans in the days of Samuel, unique as it is in position as the only high ground on the north bank of the Thames, 60 miles from the sea. Navigable, moreover, for nearly its entire length of 150 miles, the prehistoric mounds of Windsor, Wallingford and Oxford testify to the existence of early Cymric settlements on the banks of this all-important waterway on the east of the island. Brutus is celebrated in the Triads as one of the three king revolutionists of Britain. The Trojan system, under him, being incorporated with the patriarchal. The changes which the Trojan prince intended to carry out may have influenced his choice in making the port of the Llandin his capital, a trading centre, removed from the immediate influence of the Druidic authorities at Avebury, who would naturally have resented any innovation of their own ancient laws. It is satisfactory to find the text of the Triad confirmed by the most learned jurists who refer the original institutes of our island to the Trojan law brought by Brutus. Lord Chief Justice Cope, in his preface to Volume 3 of Report, affirms that the original laws of this land were composed of such elements as Brutus first selected from the ancient Greek and Trojan institutions. It is to these native laws, says Morgan, and not, as has been absurdly alleged, to any foreign or continental source, German, Saxon, or Norman, Britons have in all ages been indebted for the superior liberties they have enjoyed as contrasted with other nations. Lord Chancellor Fortescue, in his work on the laws of England, justly observes that concerning the different powers which kings claim over their subjects, I am firmly of opinion that it arises solely from the different nature of the original institutions. So the Kingdom of Britain had its original from Brutus of the Trojans, who attended him from Italy and Greece, and wove a mixed government compounded of the regal and the democratic. The most memorable of the laws of Brutus is that of the royal primogeniture, by which the succession to the throne of Britain was vested in the eldest son of the king. This was known as preeminently the Trojan Law, and has in all ages regulated the succession to the British crown among the British dynasties. It was eventually adopted by the Normans and became the law of England. Another fundamental ordinance established by Brutus was that the sovereigns of Cambria and Alban should be so far subordinate to the sovereign of Logria that they should pay him annually £40 weight of gold for the military and naval defence of the island. The whole island was never to be regarded otherwise than one kingdom and one crown. This crown was called the Crown of Britain, and the sovereignty over the whole island vested in it, the Crownship of Britain, and beneath Prydain. The military leadership remained in the eldest tribe, the Cymry, and from it the Pendragon, or military dictator, with absolute power for the time being, was, in the case of foreign invasion or national danger, to be elected. The leadership was the same as Sparta exercised in Greece and Rome in Italy. Every subject was as free as the king. There were no other laws in force than those which were known as cafrethiou, or common rights. There were no slaves. The first slaves in after times were the Cathaeon, or captives taken in war. The usages of Britain could not be altered by any act of the crown or national convention. They were now considered the inalienable rights to which every Briton was born, and of which no human legislation could deprive him. Many of these usages are remarkable for their humane and lofty spirit. For instance, there are three things belonging to a man from which no law can separate him: his wife, his children, and the instruments of his calling. For no law can unman a man, or uncall a calling. A British or Trojan law remains in full force to this day, that the sceptre of the island might be swayed by a queen as well as a king. In the Pict kingdom, the succession went wholly by the female side. Among the continental nations, no woman was permitted to reign. The Saxons considered it a disgrace to a king to be seen seated on a throne with a queen. The chariot system of warfare and the system of military castrametation are said to have been introduced into Britain by Brutus. Caesar describes both as having attained in his time the highest perfection. The British castrametation was in some important respects superior to the Roman. Another memory of the Trojan colonization is perpetuated in the numerous Troy towns or mazes cut into the turf in all parts of England, and in those which still exist in the uplands of Wales, called by the shepherds Cardroia, the city of Troy, allusion to which is made in Drechi Prif Osod and in other Welsh histories. There is nothing more popular among the Welsh, we are told, than the belief that they came originally into this island from Cardroia. This tradition has impressed itself so indelibly on the Celtic mind that we see even shepherds on the summit of every hillock making pictorial representations in the surface of the grass of the labyrinthine walls of ancient Troy. on the plains of both sides of the Solway. Mazes are also to be met with, and as in Wales, herdsmen still cut labyrinthine figures upon the turf, which they call, for no reason except that their fathers used the same expression, the Wall of Troy. Whether the name Troy Town was used generically of all turf-cut mazes, it is impossible to say, but it is certain that many of them, in different parts of the country, were so designated, and both in name and in form take us back to the classical antiquity. Even around London, the name survives. For example, at Peckham Rye, an old row of cottages built on the site which formed part of the common is called Troy Town. The upper garden at Kensington was known as the Siege of Troy. It was on this site that William III laid out a topiary maze, and about the same time he restored Henry VIII's popular maze at Hampton Court, which that monarch may have probably founded upon a yet earlier maze of unknown antiquity. At Blackheath, another maze may be identified in the midst of the prehistoric remains, where, not far from the entrance to Morden College, successive ridges and depressions, faintly discernible, represent the remains of the old labyrinthine pathway. An old survey of the manor of Greenwich shows that the familiar thoroughfare of Maze Hill led directly to the maze. At this commanding tableland was an important centre of civilization in remote antiquity, is certain from the partial remains of the prehistoric Gorset, today known as Whitfield's Mount, where, as upon similar sites in the vicinity of London previously described, the privilege of the people to hold public meetings still survives, and it is only within the memory of the present generation that the numerous barrows, which for centuries crowned the Lansdowne and the Point, commanding the river for some 6 miles on the east and west, as also upon the upper part of the Royal Park, have been ruthlessly destroyed in order to supply the ever-increasing demands for cricket and football grounds. Passing right through the middle of these tumuli on the heath ran Watling Street, the old trade route from the south coast to the Porth of the Llandin. Its northwesterly course has been traced on the high ground near Peckham, where, as we have seen, was another Troy Town, probably connected with the place of assembly, the sacred mound at Kennington. The names of Maze Pond, Maze Street and Maze Lane near the site of the old ferry on Bankside, Southwark, preserve the memory of yet another of these places of amusement, as some suppose them to have been, and suggest the presence of a large population, composed probably of traders and merchants connected with the control of the corn supplies from the numerous dean holes or granaries in Kent and Surrey, for it was at this point that food and other commodities were conveyed into the old car of New Troy. The ferry at Southwark would appear to have rivalled the ford at Westminster in importance from the fact that before a stone of the abbey was laid, we find St. Swithin, Bishop of Winchester, in the 9th century, buying up the site of the ferry and building his beautiful cathedral, to which he attached a college for the training of secular priests to minister to the spiritual needs of the people, as well as to administer civic justice. It is to the first Chancellor Bishop, St. Swithin, that the country owes the first organised attempt to re-establish the Druidic system of church and state government on Christian lines, a system peculiar to Britain, with the traditions of which the bishop would have become acquainted in Royal Winchester, where his cathedral stood on the actual site of a Druidic court of justice. It has been thought, moreover, that it was the Druidic College of Priests in the Close that suggested to St. Swithin to found theological colleges at Winchester and Southwark. Be this as it may, On the north side of the sacristy of Southwark Cathedral, the remains of the Saxon apse are said to exist, and marking the work of St Swithin as the first Chancellor Bishop of England is the original stone seat on the northeast side of the chancel, where for centuries the Bishop of Winchester held their consistory courts. Not only was the great St Swithin the founder of secular education in Saxon times, but it is to the Chancellor Bishop the Church owes the revival and restoration by statute of the Druidic law of tithes. The terrible incursions and depredations of the Danes the bishop regarded as a visitation of providence for the neglect and poverty into which the churches in all parts of the country had been allowed to fall from the lack of funds and the dearth of clergy. It was to remedy the latter need that he established his seminary at Winchester, the nursery of his college at Southwark, and in order to alleviate the former, King Ethelwulf, by his chancellor's advice, booked the tenth part of the land of the kingdom to God's praise and his own eternal welfare. The deed was written at Winchester, from early British times, to Edward III, the seat of government, and laid solemnly on the altar of the cathedral church, in presence of Swithin and the Witan, the Saxon Parliament. It was thus, by consent of the church and the state, that the payment of tithes became established as a national institution. The original charter is in the British Museum, written in the year 854, with the consent of those witnesses whose names and signatures are attached. To go further afield, in addition to the mazes at Blackheath, Peckham Bay and Southwark, there is Troy Town at Rochester, adjoining an open space called the Vines, Troy Town, 3.5 miles from Dorchester, a maze at Lee between Yetminster and Yeovil, Wick Down at Downton, Breckham Down near Salisbury, St Anne's, Snainton, Nottinghamshire, another near Ripon, Cumberton in Cambridgeshire, Carlion in Monmouthshire, and the maze at Somerton near Oxford, known to this day as Troy Town or Troy Farm. Ruskin compares the design of this Oxfordshire turf-cut Troy Town or maze to the circular labyrinth of Daedalus depicted on a stone in Lucia Cathedral, and he is the first to call attention to the fact that it closely resembles the circular labyrinth on a coin of Knossos in Crete. But the three most interesting examples are Saffron, a Walden maze, which occupies a space of 138 feet by 100, while the convolutions of its path are said to measure about a mile in length. The maze on the Winton, or the Sacred Mound of St Catherine's Hill, Winchester, and the Alkborough maze, commanding the Humber on the borders of Lincolnshire, known as Julian's Bower. It is a curious coincidence that the design of these three existing mazes should belong respectively to the types seen on the coins of Crete, casts of which have been kindly given to the author for reproduction by Mr. G. F. Hill of the Coin and Medal Department, British Museum. There is no chance resemblance, but has behind it the fact attested by Virgil that the Trojans came from Crete. Stukeley tells us that the maze at Alkborough in Lincolnshire used to be known within his own recollection as Julian's Bower, and he adds that the same name was applied to many other mazes then existing on village greens. The word bower in place names is a corruption of burg, a castle or city. Julian is probably no other than Julius or Iulus, the son of Aeneas of Troy. Julian's Bower is therefore the city of Julius, which may be taken as the equivalent of Troy Town. The names of Troy Town and Julian's Bower, applied to our ancient English mazes, were treated in uncritical times as confirmation, strong as Holy Writ, of the descent of the ancient Britons from Brutus and his Trojan followers. However much this tradition may be questioned, there must have been some reason for associating these turf-cut labyrinths on our downs and commons with the city of Priam, and the connecting link may perhaps be found in the Roman game of Troy. An animated description of the Troy game is given in the Aeneid Book 5, in a passage in which Virgil professes to afford an account of its origin. This account of Virgil's produces the impression of a bewildering complexity of movement upon clearly formulated lines, and it must be admitted that there is a striking coincidence in the fact that on the one hand we find Virgil describing the Troy game as consisting of movements which are only comparable to the entangled pathways of the labyrinth or maze of Crete, and that, on the other hand, we find our ancient turf-cut mazes, so commonly known, down even to our own time, as Troy towns or walls of Troy. The coincidence becomes all the more remarkable when we see how Virgil connects Julius with the Troy game, and recall that Julian's bower, that is, Julian's castle or city, is another name given to our old English mazes. The story of the Cretan labyrinth, referred to by Virgil in illustration of the entangled and interwoven figures of the Troy game, is familiar even in our nurseries. The skillful workman Daedalus constructed for King Minos a labyrinth, in the centre of which the Minotaur had his lair. No one who entered this labyrinth could find his way out again. The 7 young men and maidens who formed the annual tribute of Athens were sent into the maze, lost themselves in its winding passages, and were devoured by the monster. Theseus slew the Minotaur and escaped out of the labyrinth by the help of the clue which Ariadne had given him. But what had the Cretan legend to do with Troy? It is material to recall that Ilium was supposed to have been founded by settlers from Crete. Virgil tells us in the Aeneid that Crete was the cradle of the Trojan race and the source of its national religion. Virgil is understood to have based his poem upon mythical histories which have since altogether disappeared, and it may be assumed that the ethnical connection of Troy with Crete was an accepted belief in the age in which he wrote. Thus, it is possible that the story of the Minotaur may have been regarded as a legend of the Trojan people, and the famous labyrinth may have been associated in the popular mind with Troy as well as Crete. Again, it must be remembered that Troy had a legend of its own, which bore a strong resemblance to that of Crete. The story was that Neptune and Apollo appeared in the guise of men before Laomedon, king of Troy, and undertook, for an agreed price, to build a wall around the city. When the task was accomplished, Laomedon refused to pay them. Thereupon, Neptune sent a marine monster, which was wont to issue forth from the water in the fields of Ilium, seizing and devouring the inhabitants. An oracle declared that in order to appease the angry god, it was necessary for Laomedon to expose his daughter, Hesione, upon the shore, that the monster might devour her. Hesione was accordingly taken forth, but Hercules came to her rescue and undertook to destroy the monster. In order to assist him in his enterprise, Minerva built for him a wall of earth, behind which he would retire when the sea monster from the shore onto the plain would chase him. It is to this story that Shakespeare refers in The Merchant of Venice, Act 3, Scene 2. With much more love than young Alcides, when he did reduce the virgin tribute paid by howling Troy to the sea monster. The Reverend R. I. Morgan, in his History of the Cymry, referring to Laomedon, says that in the reign of the latter, The citadel and walls of Troy were rebuilt by Belin and Lev, architects of Crete, after the model of the Cretan labyrinth, which was also an exact representation of the stellar universe. This interesting statement must not be omitted, although at present science has neglected to prove its claims. Reference is also made to the walls of Troy by Ledgate in his Troy book, where he speaks of Brutus, who won Britain from the giants. Chaucer, Caxton, Denham, Milton all refer to the story of Brutus. This legend is rather alluded to than related by Homer and other writers whose works have come down to us. It is taken for granted by authorities in classical literature that a more complete and detailed narrative than we possess existed and was familiar to the ancients. One wonders whether, if the full story were before us, we should find that the analogy to the Cretan legend was carried out and that Minerva's walls were labyrinth in their form. Even without this added circumstance, is it possible that the charging and retreating, the chasing and eluding, which seem to have characterized the combat between Hercules and the Trojan monster, were sufficient to suggest the name of Troy game as descriptive of the mock combat of the Roman youths? The game may have been designated without any special reference to the labyrinthine movements of which it consisted. In London, in the days of Henry II, Fitzstephen relates that Troy game was played by the young men of the king's household every Sunday in Lent, the king and his courtiers frequently being present. Troy game on horseback continued to be played right down to the Middle Ages and was probably the origin of jousts and tournaments afterwards so popular. We have come across more than one reference to its having been played on Tothill Fields. Mimic warfare between opposing companies of schoolboys might very naturally be named after the immortal combats that formed one of the principal subjects of their lessons. Even in modern English playgrounds, the game of Greeks and Trojans still holds its place with French and English, and few among us realise that the game of Troy is still played in our streets under the name of hopscotch. Intricate lines are drawn on the pavement in chalk, and competitors try to reach the goal by devious ways. As to the origin of the word maze, it is from a Cymric word, mace, meaning greensward in the Cornish language, a field. The name seems to indicate that in some bygone age, the maze game was played on the greensward. We still use the word maze and amazement to express the bewilderment of one who knows not which way to turn. But to return to the story of the Trojan prince, the founder of London, Brutus died after a memorable reign of 24 years and was interred by the side of Imogen on the Brenguin, the White Mount. The genealogies record the names of the British kings, Brutus's descendants and successors, but it is not mentioned that any of these monarchs were buried on the royal Gorset until Donal Molmutius in the 4th century BC, whose history we shall be learning about later.